You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. And for the rest of this hour, the science of looking at art. Yeah, there is a science in looking at art. Because why is it that some paintings seem to speak to us? Is there something about the image that perhaps communicates with our subconscious? Can scientists quantify that elusive something? Well, in his new book, my next guest has shown that often they can. He argues that many of the most famous paintings in history, including the Mona Lisa, incorporate some basic mathematical concepts in their composition, often mimicking what we see in nature and making them more appealing to our subconscious. The Mona Lisa is also the perfect canvas on which to study the way that our brain, specifically our visual system, influences how we interpret a work of art. Why is her smile so elusive? Is it a trick of the light or of our peripheral vision? And why can simply putting certain colors next to each other make our brain sense motion in a painting? It can. We'll talk about it. That's what we're going to be talking about this hour. You can follow us along as we discuss the Mona Lisa by surfing over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have some unusual pictures of the Mona Lisa there at sciencefriday.com, and you can follow along as we talk about them. Let me introduce my guest. Bulent Adelay is the author of Math and the Mona Lisa, The Art and Science of Leonardo da Vinci, published by Smithsonian Books. He's also professor of physics at the University of Mary, Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and a member of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. He joins us today from our NPR studios in Washington. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flatow.
Thank you. Call me Ira. Dr. Margaret Livingston is the author of Vision and Art, The Biology of Seeing, published by Harry N. Abrams. She's also a professor of neurobiology at Harvard Medical School, and she joins us today from WBUR in Boston. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Livingston.
And thank you.
You're welcome. Let's first talk to Dr. Adelay. Before we start talking about his paintings, tell us a little bit about Da Vinci's life. He was certainly an unusual man, was he not?
He certainly was. He was an autodidact. He didn't have any formal education. He was a love child, an illegitimate child of a 24-year-old nobleman and a 15-year-old peasant in Anciano, very close to Vinci. He was born in 1452. He lived with his mother the first 5 years or so, but then his father took him when he was five. And about the time he was 15, the family moved to Florence, where he was apprenticed to a major artist, Andrea del Verrocchio. And this certainly seems to be a turning point in his life, because at least del Verrocchio was the ideal teacher for him.
What was there about the Renaissance? What changed about painting with the Renaissance?
You know, this will be a difficult concept even for scientists to understand, but I think the scientists in the Renaissance learned to observe from the artists in the Renaissance. Of course, the artists were often architects, they were sculptors, and they could see things a little better in three dimensions, and perspective, one-point perspective, then later two-point perspective, came into fore in the Renaissance.
You write in your book about Da Vinci's earliest known landscape drawing of the Arno Valley. You already see signs of the scientist in his art.
That's right. He has this great passion for geology, for biology, for chemistry, for physics. Indeed, it's really rather poignant that just before he died, he turned to an assistant and he said, did anything get done? Because so much of his genius, of course, was lost in those notebooks that appeared much, much later. But we look at his work now and we wonder whether there might have been a dozen different supremely gifted individuals all functioning with the same name.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Did he use any of his scientific intellect in making his famous painting Mona Lisa? Can you find mathematics in that painting?
I think you really can. First of all, in 1509, a book that he illustrated for the fine mathematician Luca Pacioli was published, and it reveals what Leonardo knew of the polyhedra, the polygons, and in there he also invents a new font. In any event, What I can do on my computer now using elaborate math tools, Mathematica, for example, to make these polyhedra, Leonardo invented in his head and illustrated in the book. In the Mona Lisa, you actually see this figure, this triangle, the golden triangle organizing the great lady. You also see Leonardo's passion for geology, that background, the landscape. The golden triangle, incidentally, is just a 36-degree triangle at the top and 72 degrees on the bottom. It comes from the Fibonacci series, which also gives rise to the golden rectangle. The image itself appears in the Parthenon, and there seems to be an affinity, or a human affinity, for such shapes. But it was in Fibonacci's day in the 13th century, three centuries before Leonardo, that a certain series, the Fibonacci series, was formalized, and this gives rise to a golden ratio, 1.618, which also gives rise to both the golden rectangle and the golden triangle. You see that in the Mona Lisa. Now, if you look at the great painting, you see that one side of the painting, the background, is slightly higher than the other. This tends to disarm you, and you inadvertently scan back and forth across your eyes. It's a mesmerizing influence. That's aside from the shapes in the picture, obviously.
Dr. Livingstone, you suggest that the reason the Mona Lisa's smile is so elusive is because our visual acuity changes when we're using our peripheral vision. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. Your vision is higher in your center of gaze. Most people aren't aware of it because you look around you and you think the whole image is all high resolution. But, of course, you move your eyes when you read, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can only see those tiny letters with your center of gaze. So your acuity falls off dramatically away from the center of gaze. And so most people sort of think of their peripheral vision as just not being as good as their central vision. But actually your peripheral vision is better at seeing big blurry things. And if you filter the Mona Lisa in such a way that you can see what your central vision could see, if you could see the whole thing with your central vision, as opposed to what your peripheral vision would see, it turns out that you can see her smile with your peripheral vision. You can't see it with your central vision. Her smile is blurry.
So if you stare at her mouth, you're not going to see the smile. But
right.
If you look to the side at something else in the painting, you will.
You see her smile. And so it makes it, not only does it make it elusive, it also makes it dynamic, which is what gives her this startlingly lifelike quality. As you move your eyes over the picture, which you do naturally, you move your eyes constantly, her expression changes, which is what makes her seem so alive. Gombrich says she seems to breathe. And I think that's what a lot of people find so appealing about it, is that she seems alive and you're not quite sure why. But I think it's because her expression changes dramatically as you move your eyes, and that's because her smile is very blurry.
Dr. Adelaide, what do you say about that?
I agree completely. Not only that, but there are so many. It's a universal icon, obviously, and there are as many theories as there are viewers of the painting. Over the years, I've heard a dentist claim that she had a toothache. I've heard OBGYNs claim that she had the glow of a pregnant woman. The other day, I gave a talk at Johns Hopkins, and driving out, I saw a large poster. It was a billboard, actually, and it said, "Come in for DNA testing. Do you know who the father is?" And right next to it was the pregnant Mona Lisa. In any event, this is a universal icon. I'm more, as an artist scientist, I'm more interested in the shapes rather than the colors, but I'm fascinated by Dr. Livingstone's interpretation.
Dr. Livingstone, did Da Vinci realize what he was doing? You know, that was he consciously trying to take advantage of, you know, our poor peripheral visions to bring out the smile?
Well, he kept these notebooks where he wrote down a lot of the techniques that he used, and he never wrote about this one. And apparently he was very fond of this painting and kept it with him for a few years and then gave it to the King of France. So my suspicion is it appealed to him in the same way it appeals to everybody else, but I don't think he knew why precisely.
So you think it was a mystery to him about how it turned out?
Well, he didn't do it again.
Well, how many times can you do a masterpiece? Twice, I guess. So, in other words, he didn't have a... When you say he didn't do it again, he didn't have a form.
He didn't have
He didn't have a style he's going to replicate in another picture that would turn out.
He didn't replicate that effect of an elusive emotional expression in any other painting that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Not the way this one works. If in the original in the Louvre, it's just creepy.
Now you do say that if you look at paintings and if you look at actually portraits these days, there is a replicable item in paintings about how the eyes are lined up with the center line of the paintings and the pictures that Dr. Adelaide, that you can find in paintings over the years.
This was discovered by Christopher Tyler in 1998. He's a physiologist, a neurophysiologist in San Francisco. He was working with epileptic patients, I believe, and whose left and right hemispheres had been surgically separated. And he wanted to present to these people pictures, portraits, where he had drawn a straight line right down the middle, a bisector. And to his astonishment, he came up with this discovery that in one-third of all great portraits, the center line goes right through an eye. In the next one-third, it goes within 5% of the eye.
See,
it is... And then
is that a subconscious thing of positioning people in front of the easel, or something they knew that you want to
line
it up that way?
I'm convinced it's subconscious, because when Christopher Tyler made his discovery and a whole matrix of portraits appeared in the front page of the New York Times, there was the Rembrandt self-portrait from his old age. The line went right through the eye. And there was the great Dora Maar's portrait by Picasso. And Picasso could have put the eye anywhere on the painting. In fact, if he knew about this principle, he probably would have put it in the lower left corner of the portrait. even he fell victim to the principle.
When you say the principle, is this something that Da Vinci knew about, this principle?
No. I think this is completely inadvertent. I went home and looked at some of the pictures I had taken of family members.
Yeah.
The line goes right through the eye. We focus on an eye, it seems. At least if we have an artistic bent, we do this. Mm-hmm. And this principle seems to hold for single principles portraits rather than, obviously, collective family portraits.
Hmm. Now, Dr. Livingstone, you discovered something about the difference between luminance and color in paintings that I found very fascinating. Explain that to us.
I didn't discover it. The artist discovered it. What I observed is that what they discovered has a neurobiological basis, which is the segregation of color and luminance processing in our visual system.
Mm-hmm. How do you define luminance versus color? I know when I'm in Photoshop, it says change the luminance on something, and I'm thinking, well, maybe that's the color, but it's not.
Oh, grayscale.
Grayscale.
That's luminance is grayscale.
It's grayscale.
It's sort of how much light there is, mm-hmm. but it's also how sensitive you are to that wavelength. So it's basically grayscale
in
Photoshop.
And artists are able to use the luminance to make the painting jump out at us?
Well, artists have long recognized the distinction between luminance and color. They call it value.
Mm-hmm.
So value is the technical term among artists for luminance, which us neurobiologists we call it luminance.
Mm-hmm.
But they've long recognized this distinction, that there are distinct roles for color and luminance. Picasso says luminance is all the realities in luminance alone. And the neurobiological basis for that, which we only recently tumbled to, is that part of your visual system doesn't care about color at all. And that's the evolutionarily old part of your visual system. So Picasso's right. The reality, the basic stuff about the scene, really is in luminance alone.
Hmm. Interesting. We're talking about art and the brain this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And also what the influence Da Vinci had on the world of art. Let me just follow that up. You were mentioning in your book that when you put two colors next to each other that have the same luminance, why does it look like there's movement in the painting? What is going on in your brain there?
Ah, so you have to pick. This is hard to do on the radio. You have to picture one of those annoying ads that kind of jumps around and looks creepy. It's got red text on a green background, right, or yellow text on a gray background. You know, the ones that jump and shimmer.
Right.
So once you've got that idea, artists call that equal value, and it is known to have this peculiar, nasty, shimmery quality. Mm-hmm. Well, the part of your brain that can't see color, the evolutionarily old part of your brain, which is the part of the primate brain that we share with other mammals, is basically grayscale. So mm-hmm. if you took a black and white photograph of that ad, you would see nothing. You would not see the colored text against the other colored background because they're equiluminant. And so the part of your brain that's responsible for telling you whether there is or is not any movement can't see it. But then the primate-specific, newer part of your brain can see it, but it can't tell where it is, and so it can seem to move.
Oh,
so we think that's where the shimmering comes from, that your motion system or your position system can't even see it.
Mm-hmm. And the artists and the painters of the Renaissance knew about this?
They knew about the peculiar – I don't know if they knew it in the Renaissance so much. Mm-hmm. It's a little more modern than that. It tends to be really came out in op art. A lot of the things that happen in op art are happening because of equiluminance.
But if you look at some of the works, and I think one of them, the Monet, is in your book. He used that as an example. He seemed to be introducing movement into his paintings. Did he know about that idea, you think?
Well, the impression – yeah, they started doing this. They discovered – it to some extent. I think op art took it to an extreme, which is why when I think of that kind of movement in art, I think more of the op art.
Right.
The Impressionists worked in groups and pairs, and they were just like scientists. They were doing experiments. They were doing visual experiments. And so I think they discovered this. They wouldn't have put it in neurobiological terms, of course, but they did have a technique, and they could communicate it to each other, and one person could figure out how to do it, and another person could try it out and get a similar effect.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Adelaide, scientists and artists, do you think there's enough commingling of their different worlds?
Unhappily, in our modern age, there isn't. And usually when you find a physicist, a theoretical physicist, who does some art, it'll be music. Einstein was a great violinist. Heisenberg was a great violinist. But this, you stop short. Alexander Borodin was a very fine composer, but a very fine chemist, rather. Ultimately, though, as Margaret and I both pondered the Mona Lisa, I think we came up with the same sort of thing about whether he was doing what he was doing on purpose. And in a sense, I think the person who captures the essence of this is Sherwin Nuland, a personal favorite writer. He was a...
Dr. Adelaide, we have to...
Yes.
A slave to the clock. So stay with us.
Okay.
We'll take a short break. We'll come back and talk more about the subject. And don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about Da Vinci, science and the arts, and our biology, how it influences the way we see art, with my guest, Puland Adelaide, author of Math and the Mona Lisa, The Art and Science of Leonardo da Vinci, Margaret Livingstone, author of Vision and Art, The Biology of Seeing. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. When I rudely interrupted Dr. Adelaide, he was talking about something interesting, making an interesting point, which is what we normally associate scientists and musicians, you know, the Einsteins, other people who play violins and things, but not usually science and artists, Dr. Butele. Adelaide, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. I was going to speak about Sherwin Nuland, who is a personal favorite author of mine. He was a surgeon at Yale, and he wrote a wonderful book called Leonardo da Vinci, a little penguin book. And in his profile, he speaks about Leonardo as quite simply the finest anatomist in history. Mm-hmm. Now, this is 500 years ago. But there's one paragraph that I thought was especially poignant in his book, and I quoted it in my book. Kenneth Clark, you might know, is the legendary art historian at Oxford. He was. here's Sherwin Newland. If he is, speaking about Leonardo, as Sir Kenneth Clark so appropriately calls him, the most relentlessly curious man in history, he's also the historical figure about whom we're most relentlessly curious. The dates, the facts, the known events are far fewer than we need if we are to understand how such a being could have existed. The enigma of the Mona Lisa's smile is no less than the enigma of her creator's life force. Or perhaps the smile is in itself Leonardo's ultimate message to the ages. There is even more to me than you can ever capture, though I have spoken so intimately to you in my notebooks, even as I have spoken to myself. I have kept final counsel only with the depths of my spirit and the inscrutable source that has made me possible. Seek as you may, I will commune with you only so far. The rest is withheld, for it was my destiny to know things you will never know. You see, we can all speculate about precisely what Leonardo knew when he did this painting, or The Last Supper, which is the other great psychological painting of the period.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Megan in St. Louis. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
I guess what I'm wondering is, and I tend to talk in circles, so I'll try not to.
Join the crowd.
I think probably in Da Vinci's time, and I can think also of other examples, Thomas Jefferson, Richard Feynman, there was an acceptance of learning several different studies, much like you've said. And I wonder if we don't lose some opportunities to make connections like this because of our emphasis on studying business for money or something like that. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, there was a very famous book, C.P. Snow, called The Two Cultures in the 50s. It was written about the very thing that you talk about, I think, you know, the separation of different intellectuals, were the scientists versus the people who, so to speak, read books, you know,
right.
Poetry and stuff. And I know Dr. Adelaide was writing that he thinks we're into a third culture now. Correct?
Tell me.
Yes. Shall I take over?
Yes, go ahead.
Please.
Yes. Yes, the third culture I mentioned, C.P. Snow, at the very time he brought this out, was at the threshold of a new culture that was being born, the computer age. There are something like 1.2 billion PCs in the world right now, and we can't exist, it seems, without a screen in front of us. But 50 years ago, the sectors were a little bit wider, and the internal division certainly existed between them. Now they seem even deeper. It's really too bad, but the cross-dissemination is often a very creative way of pursuing knowledge.
It is. I wish we got the chance to hear it more often from just regular people. I think they'd make some amazing connections.
Well, kids they cut the budgets these days. One of the first things they cut out of school is music and the arts.
It's true. It makes me crazy.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. Tell us, Dr. Livingstone, tell us more about the biology of seeing and how that works with artistry. What could we look for in paintings? Or what should we look for that might help us understand how our biology is linked with artistry?
Well, what I've been doing is looking at paintings that over time have proven to be paintings that have meant a lot to people or astonished them or have become loved for various reasons, and filtered out all the ones that I don't want to deal with, which is the ones that are cultural reasons or political reasons or deep psychological reasons. And then I'm left with the ones that people find are interesting visually.
Universally.
And yeah. For just real low-level visual reasons.
Yeah.
And then as a scientist, I say, well, what is it that artist has done? What has that artist discovered that I, as a neuroscientist, can perhaps gain some insight either into neurobiology or some insight just into what it is the artist did? Because they can discover things without understanding the neurobiology, but it helps me as a neurobiologist to see what they've done. And then I would like to pass it back again to the artist and say, listen, this is something that you guys have figured out. And you can either understand it in terms of value and luminance, or you can understand it in terms of how your brain is, how the human brain is organized, and maybe that might make it even easier to understand what you're doing.
Are there some artists we talked about? You know, some of the later day more modern artists who figured out the luminance idea. Are there other artists who figured out this connection possibly subconsciously?
You mean with luminance and color?
Well, without luminance, with some other trick or some other thing they've stumbled on.
Yes. One of my favorites is the strange depth effects that you can get starting with the Impressionists. They said they like to paint the air. And I think that they tumbled to something that's a feature of the way we see depth, which is that we see depth because of the difference in the images in our two eyes. And you know magic eye images, those things that some people can see and some people can't that give you these really interesting 3D effects?
You have to stare at it. Yeah, that thing.
Well, you also have to have good stereopsis and you have to know how to diverge your eyes. But beyond that, for those people who can see those things, I think some of the Impressionist paintings do a similar trick and create an artificial volume by the way the little dots can match up differently in your two eyes. And Klimt, I think, tumbled to this.
Dr. Adelaide, did Da Vinci understand that there were pleasing forms, mathematically pleasing forms in his pictures that would make us appreciate them more?
I think so. I think so. Besides the golden triangle that I mentioned organizing the Mona Lisa, if you look at his three portraits of women, he painted, I should start say at the outset, Leonardo, this supreme artist, painted only about a dozen paintings in his entire life. Number one and number two, most famous in the world, happened to be by him, but he was a part-time artist. Now, in the three portraits of women painted about 15 years apart, the Ginevra, that's in Washington, D.C., the Cecilia Gallerani, the lady with an ermine, and the Mona Lisa, there are a couple of other symmetries. For example, if you draw a square just around the head, the height of the head being the side of the height of the square, and then extend it down 62%, that would make it a golden rectangle. The bodice goes right through the edge of that rectangle, the golden rectangle, and this is true in all three of the paintings. You draw the diagonals of the square, the lines go right through the eye. The center point is right, again, the eye. Whether he was doing this on purpose or whether it was his unerring eye, the artist's eye, we'll never really know because he doesn't have notes about them. He does have notes, however, about the proportions of the ideal face, and these almost always are in the golden ratio, 1.6, 1.62, the height of the forehead to the length of the nose, the length of the nose to the upper lip, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Margaret Livingstone, I'll ask both of you, when we go outside and we see a beautiful scene and it's breathtaking or whatever, do we know why that is? What's going on in our brain? It says, hey, wow, look at that sunset, that landscape, or whatever it is.
Let me defer to Margaret on this.
Dr. Living, you know, because I'm asking, because it seems that that Dr. Adelaide is sort of taking the mystery out of the beauty by trying to quantify what makes things appealing by saying, you know, Da Vinci knew how to make this, he knew these proportions were appealing, this golden triangle, whatever. Is he just imitating what nature is doing in, you know, out there by putting it on a canvas? And is there something hardwired in our brain in those proportions or whatever that makes us say, hey, that's beautiful?
How about, can we talk about music?
Sure.
As an analogy?
Sure.
Tonality and scales and harmonics we find pleasing. And they're so universal that you might think that it's somehow hardwired, that for some bizarre reason our nervous systems are wired up to like these particular sounds. But your nervous system is actually wired up through experience, hugely wired up through experience. Most of it isn't hardwired. The program is just there, how you interact with your environment. And that stuff is out there in resonant structures of real objects and in resonant structures of animals and people's vocal tracks. And so I think we find the sounds that are in music pleasing because they're either extrapolations of the kinds of sounds you hear in nature or that you've heard throughout your experience. Mm. And similarly, I think the particular ratios that we've been talking about are things that are also present in nature simply because of the way things divide. You have one daughter cell that divides into two daughter cells and so on, and you get these repeating patterns like the Fibonacci series for fairly simple biological reasons. And then if you see them a lot in nature and you get used to them, and then in a painting it carries it one step further but echoes something that you've learned through your experience, mm-hmm. I think that's where you get this sense of familiarity and yet unfamiliarity that may be what we call aesthetics. I mean, what makes something pleasing? I don't think any of us have a real good handle on.
We're talking about the brain and biology this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. A couple of questions from our listeners. Let's see if we can go to them. Is it Katie in Davis, California?
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
My comments have changed from the original reason why I called, but hearing your speakers talk about the Fibonacci numbers and the golden rectangle, I was a fifth grade teacher for 3 years in the greater Sacramento area, and my class was full of Mexican migrant children. And one rainy day recess, I pulled out this video that was in the depths of my closet from like the 1950s or 60s called The Golden Triangle, and it was made by the Disney Company, and it varied, you know, cartoonish, but it shows in fifth grade terms what the golden triangle, the golden rectangle is, and how prevalent it is in everything, architecture, nature. And my fifth graders that could barely speak English picked up on this so well, and they were bringing me in snails and sunflowers and just so many different things from nature that are examples of Fibonacci numbers. And I think that, you know, if we have those resources and if teachers are willing to go out on a limb, when it may not be a standard that they have to teach, that it's something that our children are going to love. So I just wanted to make that comment.
It's a great observation. So they didn't have to be taught. They just loved it.
Right. But, and it was because it was a video that they, yeah, you know, pop in a video and any kid will watch it. But they, you know, understood that they had these things growing in their houses and that it was all around them.
And these were pleasing forms and shapes that they wanted to collect also, bring in.
That's right.
Huh. All right. Thank you for changing your topic.
Well, can I ask my original
sure,
question?
Sure, go ahead.
It goes back even before Da Vinci. It's something that I'd heard that...
Got to go quickly because...
Okay, got it. Buddha, every painting of Buddha, no matter whether it's the size of a mural or 2 inches tall, all the proportions are the same. What can your speakers say to that?
10 seconds. Anybody can take a stab at that?
I don't know about the proportions of the Buddha paintings. I do know that in the 19th century, Gustav Fechner, who was a psychologist, cut parallelograms, squares, with different proportions, and he flashed them to people and had them select the one that appealed to them the best. And then when he published his results, one could easily make a histogram, a frequency chart, and you can see that the histogram looks very much like a bell-shaped curve.
Dr. Adelaide,
peaks at 1.6. Yeah.
I have to interrupt because we've run out of time. We'll have you back and talk more about it. Butin Adelaide, author of Math and the Mona Lisa, The Art and Science of Leonardo da Vinci, also with us today. Margaret Livingstone, author of Vision and Art, The Biology of Seeing. Thank you both for joining us this hour. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Gaelic, Paul Masiello, and Rigo Cardi in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we have to bid a farewell today. Adieu to intern Erica Altman, who's become part of our Science Friday family. And her quick wit and Australian sensibilities are certainly going to be missed on this side. Thank you, Erica. And please stay in touch. We've run out of time. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.